what I want to do is talk about what I see as the larger context. This is going to be, hopefully not an entirely unsatisfactory big think talk about the larger context for the political and social upheavals that we're all living through in the moment. One way to describe it could be how I understand the populist upsurge of our time. Why the upsurging populism? What does it mean? What does it mean for us? And then how religious believers ought to approach this upsurge in populism? So that's my agenda. My purpose today. And, you know, one of the dangers of being a journalist, and I'm a recovering academic and now a fully paid up journalist, is that a journalist has to write over and over and over again. And so you wind up saying the same things over and over and over again. So I will apologize to anybody in this room where what I'm going to say sounds too familiar. It's just one of the liabilities of what you do as a journalist is that you have to say the same thing over and over again. So last fall, I received a submission from a young writer who lives in Australia. And we're still working to try to get his piece into shape. But I was very struck by the last sentence of the submission that he sent in. It ends in this kind of arresting sentence. It reads as follows. I'm a 27-year-old, and I hope to live to see the end of the 20th century. Now, I sympathize with the sentiment behind this paradoxical aspiration. I mean, how could a 27-year-old in 2016, when I got the piece, hope to live to the end of a century that already ended? I sympathize with the sentiment because it seems like we've reached a series of dead ends in the West. I think there are political and there are cultural dead ends. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Americans thought that the world stage was going to be cleared for our benevolent power to lift up the rest of the world, or at least significant portions of the world, to the bright uplands of liberal democracy and free market prosperity. That was the kind of hope. The European Union moved from strength to strength, and it positioned the nations of Europe as forerunners in a coming system of international cooperation and soft power. But the hoped for utopias have not come to pass. And what we once thought the ideal or even inevitable future now brings frustration, disgruntlement, and incipient rebellion. And the rebellion is not just coming from non-Western nations or peoples that resist our triumphalism, but it's coming from within our own countries and from our own people. And so for good or for ill, it seems to me that the last century is finally ending. Now, one sure sign of the eclipse of this change, one sure sign of the change or the fact that the wheels of history are turning is the collapse of the classic structure of modern Western politics, which since the Industrial Revolution has revolved around the divergent interests of labor and capital. Now we see this, I think, most clearly in Europe, but I think in the United States as well, where establishment parties now cooperate to fend off anti-establishment challenges. And not always successfully, as the recent votes for Brexit and against the Italian constitutional reform indicate. Now, our constitutional system here in the United States stands in the way of coalition governments. But our last presidential election featured an anti-Trump consensus among elites, and it's a consensus that transcended traditional left-right distinctions. So it was a kind of our form of a kind of coalition government to resist established anti-establishment challenge. And once again, it seems to me that given the outcome in November, that the establishment consensus failed to carry the day. So the wheel of history, as I said, seems to be turning. Now, in this changing political environment, the central and divisive issue seems to be the role and future of the nation. That seems to be the divisive issue. Will we enter This is kind of one way of thinking about it. Will we enter into the shining future of a prosperous, globalized world without borders that's managed by experts and guided by the high ideals of human rights? Or will we return to the dark days of racism, nationalism, war, and concentration camps? Now, obviously, for me to put our present situation in these terms is tendentious, but it's exactly how the establishment side tends to express what is at stake. And more than tangentious, I also think it's metaphysically insufficient. I'm using the word metaphysically here in the journalistic sense. Our political struggles over nations and nationalism, I think, is better understood as a referendum on the West's metapolitics over the last three generations. So there's a kind of metapolitics or a consensus about how to shape public life morally and spiritually that overarches our electoral politics. And that this metapolitics has been one of disenchantment. And the rising populism that we're seeing throughout the West reflects a desire for the return of the strong gods to public life. So a desire for reenchantment, a return of the strong gods to public life. Hence, a great deal of anxiety. And I'll say more about that in this talk. So, the metapolitics. Max Weber is the figure one thinks of when one thinks of disenchantment, and he anticipated this metapolitics in his famous address, Science as Vocation. And he thought that a clear-thinking, modern person should recognize that our scientific age has broken the metaphysical bond between fact and value, the bond between our analytic capacities as modern intellectuals and the pressing questions of how we should live and what we should live for. That bond had been broken. We had to live in a world where we had to live with a kind of cold reason rather than, if you will, sort of warm truths. And needless to say, in the first half of the 20th century, Weber's severe intellectualism did not hold sway. In 1914, the strong gods of nationalism drove Europe into a terrible and pointless war. Then, after exhausting themselves, these gods and others, even worse, roused themselves for still another round of violence and bloodshed, this time on a global scale, and it ended with Europe in ruins. Now, the strong gods discredited themselves in the first half of the 20th century. And after 1945, I submit that Max Weber's notion of disenchantment, which he saw as a kind of fate of the modern person in an industrial, bureaucratic, scientific culture. He thought it was a fate, and perhaps a bad fate, but a fate we had to accept. It actually became a positive program in 1945, and it became a positive program for cultural renewal. A consensus formed in the West that we could not endure another round of nationalistic zealotry, and therefore the way forward would require weakening the powerful loyalties that bound men to their homelands. Now, in some circles, this consensus also held that communist totalitarianism suffered from the same dark disease, and in this case, it was a kind of ideological fervor that blinds us. And here again, many assumed that the restoration of a more humane way of life in the West would require a kind of a softening and a weakening. Now, in light of this consensus in the immediate post-war period, steps were taken to disenchant and desacralize public life. The European coal and steel community represented an effort to apply the balm of commerce to the wounds that had historically divided Europe. You think of Adam Smith that makes the observation that commerce tends to soften men and make them more cooperative in pursuit of their common interests. And this initiative, the European Coal and Steel Community, which is the genesis of the European project that culminated in the European Union, this initiative was part of a larger and very powerful cultural trend in the post-war era that tended to make strong claims taboo. I think the popular influence of French existentialism, for instance, in the 50s and 60s is a case in point. Albert Camus represented an effort to articulate a form of humanism that required no authoritative tradition, no authoritative institution, and no authoritative form of life. And I think that the desire for some kind of vision of a humane way of living without strong claims, strong gods, I think was a key to his importance as a figure, which I think we can't underestimate. And in retrospect, was a major figure, a Nobel Prize in Literature, I think, in 1960. In the aftermath of the civilizational crisis of 1914 to 1945, the imperative of weakening—that's the metapolitics—is a disenchantment or an imperative of weakening—affected everything. And it's for this reason that the Second Vatican Council, which met in the early 1960s, was inevitably interpreted as a liberalizing and secularizing project of what were once authoritative and transcendent dogmas. And the actual content of the Church documents, the Vatican II documents, really mattered very little on how the Council was received. For the Church, too, was swept up into the imperative of disenchantment. And I think it's helpful to look back on Catholic history and how the spirit of Vatican II took on a life of its own in light of this larger cultural imperative of disenchantment. In the United States, the dominant liberalism of the 1950s cultivated a pragmatic approach, and it claimed to be, in many cases, post-ideological. And it's interesting, in 1945, one of the helpful books for me George Marsden's The Twilight of American Liberalism, very important and helpful book about post-war American liberalism. In 1955, Walter Lippmann published Essays in the Public Philosophy, and in that book, he expressed the concern that liberal democracy becomes vulnerable if it loses touch with the deeper metaphysical warrants for itself. And it's interesting that in 1955, the book was not well received by liberal reviewers. A number of the reviewers recognized that Lippmann's project marked a descent from the post-war consensus of disenchantment. And some suggested it had authoritarian implications. It's very interesting. I think the reviewer from the New Republic said it had a kind of crypto-fascist implications, Lippmann's book. It's interesting the way that strong claims and fascism are always associated with each other, and the concerns about fascism have returned again this year. So the disenchanting imperative really broadened in May 1968 for Europeans. It is forbidden to forbid. That was the paradoxical slogan of students that they wrote onto the walls in Paris. And it marks well, I think, the trajectory of the post-war era. And that slogan meant that everything strong and limiting goes. We have to weaken social authority so that we can live more fully. That's the idea that not just to drive the strong gods out of political matters so that we can not enter into terrible wars against each other, but let's drive strong claims out of culture itself so that we can live more openly and more freely and more naturally. Now, I don't need to recount the cultural revolutions of the 1960s. They're familiar to everyone in this room because, after all, we live amidst their successes and their consequences. But what's less widely appreciated, I think, maybe it is widely acknowledged, but equally important is 1989. Before the fall of the Berlin Wall, the existential threat posed by communism kind of pressured the West, and it pressured the West to maintain a kind of concentrated political will of resistance or assertion vis-a-vis the communist other. So we had to steel ourselves somehow to speak forcefully about the virtues of a free society. Now, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, America and Western Europe, I think, have largely relaxed. We become very confident that our way of life will be vindicated, had been vindicated by the collapse of the Soviet Union and kind of rules the roost. And, everybody likes to quote Francis Fukuyama, end of history. So if we're at the end of history in some sense, we this project of securing a better future doesn't really require strenuous effort. We don't need to muster a political will, and it doesn't really require any philosophical justification. Because the project of making the world a better place is going to be carried forward by global capitalism and democracy. And these things have their own intrinsic momentum, along with legal and bureaucratic apparatus of transnational institutions and structures, which have their own logic of expansion and development. So these things are going to sort of happen, whether we want them to or not. That was a kind of strong feeling operative, I think, in the 1990s. And I think it actually still continues to this day, although, like I say, we're coming to the end of the era. We're all feeling like, maybe some of the assumptions we made are no longer something we can really count on. But in my reading, a couple of decades ago, or maybe a little bit less, I came across Gianni Vattimo. And Gianni Vattimo is a kind of journalist philosopher in Italy who I think has a particularly good ability to kind of express in kind of quasi-philosophical terms the spirit of the post-89 era and therefore help me understand this larger, what I call metapolitics. And I think he's one of the best apologists for what I call kind of end-of-history neoliberalism. So he fancies himself a man of the left, but I think he's actually, you know, a particularly good apologist for the neoliberal status quo. He synthesizes different trends in contemporary intellectual culture, and they all contribute to what he calls, and this is his terminology, the destiny of weakening, which he thinks is the destiny of the West and therefore the destiny of the whole world. And that's his way of speaking, I think, about disenchantment. We are shifting from, this is the way he thinks it, we're shifting from ontology of substance, he says, to an ontology of event, something that's enduring to something that's transient, event. I always tell students when I used to teach theology, never trust anyone who speaks about the Christ event, because that's a rhetoric of weakening for Christian doctrine. It helped in this movement towards something more transient helps us move away from an authoritarian mode of thinking for Vattimo to a mode of thinking that encourages freedom. That's one of his motifs. We've got to get away from authoritarian thinking to a mode that encourages freedom. And our present day view of the good life, he says, has, and this is his language, it has, quote, features of lightning. And this doesn't mean lightning bolts, but kind of making things more airy, more open, more porous. And all of this is, I think, summed up in the catchphrase that he uses quite often in his work, where he speaks about the weakening of being, a good Heideggerian being, big capital B being. And it's weakening. And he thinks this is a kind of happy unburdening of the West. The West can kind of finally slough off the kind of compulsive need for something enduring and substantial, and it can live more openly and more freely. And he thinks it's a development to be encouraged because weakening promotes tolerance, peace, and freedom. If there are no strong truths, then nobody will judge others or limit their freedom. If nothing is worth fighting for, nobody will fight. Now, Vattimo looks forward to a disenchanted world that encourages to adopt what he calls, quote, a moderate and generous approach to life. I really think Vattimo is really worth visiting. He's not a thinker so much as he kind of distills, I think, in a particularly astute way, the spirit of the post-89 age. So therefore, the great commandment is not to love our neighbor as ourselves. Instead, the great commandment is to go easy on our neighbors as we go easy on ourselves. Now, Vattimo speaks in this kind of postmodern philosophical patois, but I think it's interesting if you go from Vattimo and you start reading contemporary economists, they wind up actually sounding very similar. They say pretty much the same thing. Now, I've gone back to this essay on foreign affairs by Larry Summers, and Kishore Mahbubani too many times, so forgive me if you've already read something where I've talked about it. But they've got an article that defends global neoliberalism as an economic project. And it's titled The Fusion of Civilizations, A Case for Global Optimism. And they wrote it last spring. It was published last spring, but it was clearly written to try to buck up those of us who are doing the commitment to globalism against this emerging nationalistic populism. And obviously the very title, Fusion of Civilizations, is meant to reject Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations notion. But for Huntington, there's just something about the human condition that we consolidate around these kind of strong civilizational claims. And there's no way we can get around that. And that we have to take that human impulse seriously, this impulse to sort of to find these strong central cores around which we organize ourselves. Instead, they assume, Larry Summers and Mahbubani assume that civilizational differences are being transcended or at least sidelined by a global consensus. And the global consensus they see is a kind of emphasis on, this Yale, circa 2016, pragmatic problem solving of the difficulties that real people face in the real world that's going to be based on science and technology, which is a universal discourse globally. And that this is going to be then, this pragmatic problem solving is going to give rise to and be supported by a stable and sustainable rule-based order that's global in scope, that's going to ensure fairness, roughly, and then also protect human rights. And so obviously with this vision that, which I think is, you know, I think is fairly widespread, has been fairly widespread, and I think institutions like Yale are very committed to this as kind of their moral mission is to promote the evolution or the emergence of this kind of more globalized, a globalized, not quite culture, but a globalized consensus. It's one of moderation and weakening, just like Vatimo said. Instead of the strong gods of traditional culture, the globalized future is going to be governed by what I call the weak hearth gods. And the weak hearth gods are the gods of health, wealth, and pleasure. And so the neoliberal high priests of the future are going to be medical experts, central bankers, and celebrity chefs. Now, to a great extent, the weak gods already govern in the United States and in Europe. Establishment politics is best understood as promoting and sustaining the general pattern of weakening and the rule of the hearth gods, I would submit. And the rising populism, or so-called anti-establishment politics, represents a revolt against this pattern of weakening. And the reasons for this uprising are undoubtedly very multifaceted, complex, and are always influenced by the unique circumstances of different countries. I mean, why Donald Trump got elected is really very different from why different factors and why the Brits went for Brexit or why the Italians deep sixed the constitutional reform and whether or not Geert Wilders' vote totals increase or Marine Le Pen's increase. That these are all very complex and multifaceted, and they differ from place to place. But nevertheless, I think they're united by a common pattern of revolt against weakening. As an ongoing project of cultural deregulation, it seems to me, disenchantment and weakening resemble economic deregulation. In concert with economic deregulation, this kind of cultural deregulation or cultural weakening, which has accelerated since 1989, interestingly, erodes the stable bases for working class and middle class life in the West, I would submit. The notion of neoliberal is really the best concept, I think, to describe this regime of economic and cultural deregulation. I mean, there's a connection. We see this in our own politics where progressivism really unites around progressive is a kind of pro-market, pro-global markets, pro-kind of cultural deregulation fusion, which I think is more and more characteristic of elite opinion, and then left and right only varies in questions of degree. This tends to dissolve the strong elements of traditional society. and anything that might impede the free flow of commerce, identity, and desire. They all kind of wind up going together in the neoliberal system. And this may work well for the global elite, but ordinary people increasingly doubt it works well for them. In my book, Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, I try to develop ways in which this is not working for ordinary people. It could be the case, as I try to argue in many places, that disenchantment serves the interests of elites, encouraging them to discount the interests of the great majority below them on the social scale. I don't want to go into all that, and I could be very wrong about how this all shakes out. But it's becoming increasingly clear that a substantial number of voters in the West are rejecting the neoliberal project, which is a cultural project as well as an economic project. It's essential to recognize it's a cultural as well as an economic. So deregulation on both fronts. It's a globalized market, and it's also a globalized consensus that wants to sideline strong cultural claims. Now, the populist revolt is clearest in the calls for renewed national identity. It's something been brought into sharp relief by anxieties about mass immigration, much more so in Europe than in the United States, but obviously still here as well. This notion that the populism is a referendum on the politics of disenchantment and weakening, it's fascinating to see the protests after the Trump executive order about immigration. I saw as a defense of the project of disenchantment and weakening. The people who were protesting that executive order knew full well what that was. It was a reversal of a trajectory of opening the world up so that borders become less determinative of our destiny as human beings, so we can live more openly on a global scale and not have to live in a kind of confined way. And that people intuitively recognize that that's also related to a lot of moral and cultural issues, the question of borders. Immigration is tied up with all kinds of cultural re-strengthening, re-consolidation, re-establishment of boundaries. And people intuitively know that that's the case. So when they're protesting at JFK, they're not just protesting on behalf of the few thousand of people who may be affected by the order. They're primarily protesting because they do not want to see a reversal of this metapolitics of disenchantment and weakening. That's why there's so much energy and passion in this current political moment. So national identity, our political establishments have inherited the post-war imperative of disenchantment. We're socialized to believe we have a fundamental moral duty to resist populist calls for a more nationalistic politics. I think Yale is a place that socializes us, and our high school educations, our undergraduate educations, socialize us to believe we have a fundamental moral duty because our establishment defends diversity and inclusion. Because it promises, those notions promise a world that is more at peace. And it also is constantly looking back to 1945 as a threat. A politician or public figure who stands for something strong, I would submit, whether it's in nationalism or traditional morality, which ought to be really quite different, invariably gets described as authoritarian. In Europe, we're warned that we must prevent a return of fascism. In the United States, our history is different, and so racism plays the same role fascism does in our public imagination. And so that becomes the kind of thing to fight against and to warn against. And I've heard sophisticated people offer, to me, sincere analysis of Trump voters or Le Pen voters or Brexit voters. I've heard them give sincere analysis in terms of Hitler, Mussolini, and the Ku Klux Klan. And this is a sign of how deeply invested our establishment is in the post-war era, which is defined by events that happened between 1914 and 1945. We're still deeply invested in the patterns of thought of the post-war era. And it encourages us to meet every challenge that we face in public life, every challenge with a kind of redoubled effort of disenchantment and weakening. Now, I believe that the populist rebellion is going to intensify in the coming years. It's going to intensify, and that the establishment resistance to this is also going to intensify. So the call for the strong gods is going to intensify, and the repudiation of that call is going to intensify. And this is going to precipitate a series of political crises in the West. The post-war consensus marshals cultural and political power to condemn the return of the strong gods in the strongest possible terms. You get a kind of inflation now. We get a kind of rhetorical inflation. Racism, xenophobia, fascism, bigotry. These are all these heavy, these are 8-inch howitzers pounding away at challenges to the post-war consensus. Now, what form these crises are going to take, I really cannot predict. But it's not beyond my imagination that the European Court of Human Rights will reverse a national vote in the next few years by declaring the election of a right-wing candidate a violation of human rights. I mean, I don't put it beyond. That's possible to me that the EU Court of will void a national election in Europe. But it just seems to me, or maybe there'll be some other nullification of populist sentiment, but it seems to me the crisis probably is coming. I think the United States is in a much better position than Europe is. For put simply, populism wishes for something sacred in public life. And national heritage is the obvious instance. It was where an already secularized Europe defaulted to the nation as what's the only thing sacred left at the beginning of the 20th century. And it's not surprising that it's returning to that at the beginning of the 21st century. Yet our political culture has been shaped by a pattern of weakening and disenchantment that cannot accommodate this desire for the sacred. Hence the collision between these two things. People are saying we want something sacred, and we have a political culture that says it's the sacred in public life that brings death, destruction, and harm, and that these things are on a collision course with each other. Now, I'm somewhat at a loss at this point in my own thinking to explain my forebodings. I mean, I gave some forebodings in the previous paragraph. So I want to just offer some impressionistic experiences or thoughts. I was recently in Europe for some discussions, and a young woman from France made a very impassioned speech that opened my eyes to the deeper issues at stake in populism, in Europe mostly, but also maybe in the United States as well. She told her listeners at this meeting that she was in the middle class and therefore could not afford to live in neighborhoods that have no Muslims, as she said quite bitterly, rich French are able to do. And so she knows their ways, and which includes, as she said, a tradition of returning on the holidays to Tunisia or Algeria to visit relatives. And they're quite explicit, she said, that such trips are cherished opportunities to go home. And she used whatever, I can't remember what the Arabic word is for home. And she said, these are quite explicitly returns home. And then at that point in her very impassioned speech, her voice wavered. And she said, if I lose France, where can I go? And I was rocked back in my chair. I cannot imagine a political emotion more explosive than the fear of homelessness. And I can't imagine a less effective response to that fear than denouncing her as Islamophobic. For this is a weakening trope that demands that she give up her desire for a home. And a vigorous strategy of disenchantment can only make her more fearful that France's leadership class will be complicit in her homelessness. And this is going to deepen her mistrust for them and strengthen her commitment to populism. So thinking like, wow, I just found myself thinking, this is not good. Another impression I had, Julia Yaffe, I don't know if anybody follows her as a journalist. She's very accomplished. She writes for mainstream newspapers and magazines. She writes about Russia, where she immigrated from as a young child. She does very intelligently and thoughtfully. I was struck, however, by a recent tweet of hers. And this was after Trump's election. And it reads as follows. Russian government media watchdogs block all Russian access to YouPorn and Pornhub. Is this the America you want, Donald? Now, joining Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin as anti-liberal authoritarians is now commonplace. And we're in the midst of this kind of crazy We're in this kind of crazy sort of, I don't know, what's it, Hegel says, history first comes as tragedy, then as comedy. We're in the midst of this kind of comedic neo-McCarthyite moment people are secret agents of Russia. It is very comic at this point. So this linkage of Putin and Trump is very common, but it's more telling is this reductio ad absurdum of the pattern of weakening or the politics of disenchantment. I mean, has the high moral mission of neoliberalism really come down to a defense of a global right to unlimited access to pornography? Now, it's obviously unwise to read too much into tweets, especially presidential tweets. And there's good reasons to worry about illiberalism. I mean, it's not stupid to worry about Vladimir Putin. It's not, and it's good reason to worry about, or it's also good reasons to worry about anti-Muslim sentiment, too. I mean, there are good reasons to worry about illiberalism, both here in the United States and abroad. Nevertheless, I think Yaffe's political sensibilities are widespread, and they dovetail with Vattimo's view of weakening and disenchantment as a kind of happy fate. And they also dovetail with his view that any form of moral authority or regulation represents an evil regression backwards, which will eventually take us to fascism. A couple of years ago, United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power sought to counter Putin's annexation of Crimea. Of course, she could only do so in a symbolic way. And she chose to host a party for Pussy Riot, a group of performance artists known for staging public orgies and other transgressions. Now, all this is very familiar. I mean, Pussy Riot is engaging in a very standard strategy of disenchantment through transgression. And this is widely celebrated by our establishments as integral to cultural progress. Just as it is forbidden to forbid, today it is conventional to be unconventional. Now, at the outset, I'd say we are coming to dead ends. Now, Samantha Power obviously thinks in accord with the post-war consensus, which socializes us to believe that we're serving the common good insofar as we're weakening strong gods, weakening strong norms, and weakening strong truth claims. Yet the same consensus now tells us that I must choose between pornographic transgression and Putinism. Just as it is telling a young French woman that she has to choose between multicultural utopianism and fascism. And these are not happy choices. And a political culture that frames our most important public questions in these ways is in trouble, which is one reason why we're all feeling a lot is at stake right now. We're framing questions in ways that are not happy ways to frame them. All right, well, I've kind of painted a dark picture. So I want to conclude with a discussion of our role, what we ought to, how we ought to approach this this time of potential crisis. It seems to me that our elites, and we're all a part of that world, most of us in this room, probably all of us in this room, we're all trained in an anti-metaphysical materialism as a metaphysical view in the strict sense of the term. Economics is the queen of the sciences, by and large, in our time, at least in public debate. And in this atmosphere, as Christians and as religious believers and as people of goodwill, we need to break with the post-war consensus and refuse to join our voices to the conventional disenchanting denunciations of the populist desire for a return of sacredness and strong loyalties to public life. The imperative of weakening has made a great deal fluid and uncertain, and has left us with very little that is solid and trustworthy. It is not good for man to be alone, and it's a sign of health in our societies that there are people who wish to reclaim, however haltingly, the nation, which is a traditional form of solidarity. There's something healthy about that, however perverted the forms may be. But at the same time, as we don't join our voices to those who think that we just need another dose of the weakening, you know, we just haven't, you know, the cancer is still spreading, you know, up the chemo, at the same time, we need to recognize the dangers and perversions that are sure to come with this request for the return of the strong gods. The nation became an idol in the past, and it can, of course, become an idol again. And in meeting this danger and others, though, we must be careful. As the post-war era ends, we do not need to redouble these establishment strategies of weakening. Populism is a rebellion against fluidity and weightlessness. And this rebellion reflects a sane desire for what I call metaphysical density. It wants strength, not weakening. Strengthening, not weakening. And our goal should be to educate this desire in a proper order of love rather than allowing ourselves to be kind of commandeered into the increasingly frantic efforts that are being now deployed to sustain the post-war era by administering this yet another dose, upping the dose of disenchantment. Let's not let ourselves be conscripted in to this presumption that weakening and disenchantment are the solution to our problems. So, proper order of love. It seems to me that there are three great covenants that anchor life and provide us with a place to stand. People want a place to stand. They want something strong. They want something solid. They don't want something that's an event. They want substance. They don't want event. They want strengthening, not weakening. And there are three great covenants that anchor life and provide us with a place to stand. And there, if we strengthen them, we can guard against perverse and destructive loves. Now, the most basic and primeval of these covenants is the domestic covenant of marriage. The union of a man and a woman stabilizes our restless longings and provides us with an experience of solidity in the service of a common good. Stability, solidity, and solidarity. For most adults, marriage teaches a deep truth about the human condition, which is that I do not live for myself. This is most people's primeval, fundamental experience of that deep truth. Now, in the metaphysical poverty that's been created by mandatory disenchantment, populism can seek the ersatz solidarity of ideological homogeneity and feelings of empowerment that flow from collective violence. I mean, one of the great dangers of populism is that it's very empowering to do things together, and it's really empowering to do destructive things together, especially for men. And the covenant of marriage guards against this perversion. Married men do not fill the ranks of paramilitary organizations, and they do not populate terrorist cells. This is not just because married men are preoccupied, and they've got soccer games that they have to go take their kids to. The covenant of marriage anchors ordinary lives in something transcendent. It serves as our most intimate and reliable experience of home, and thus provides us with the metaphysical ballast that's needed to endure the greater fluidity, heterogeneity, and change in modern civic life that's governed by the liberal norms that I think we should rightly seek to protect and preserve. Provides people with a home in a civic world that is not traditional and all-encompassing as it would be in a traditional homogeneous society. The second covenant is civic, and like marriage, it draws us together to serve something higher than ourselves. The civic covenant, and we need to encourage the fact that the civic covenant has many layers, not just one layer. There's local communities, civic organizations, school loyalties, voluntary associations, as well as an overarching devotion to one's country. And these loves create a multifaceted yet integral solidarity that teaches yet another profound truth about the human condition. And it's this, which is that that which is most precious is magnified when it is shared, not diminished. That's an important thing that people thrill to, that the things that we cherish most are magnified and not diminished when we share them. I mean, you know, obviously, truth, beauty, and goodness, the transcendentals are, they become greater, not lesser, when we share them with others. But the same thing is true for patriotic loyalty and love, or civic organizations, starting a nonprofit to help people out, or even a corporation to make money. People, you know, there's a sense in which to join together to do something magnifies rather than diminishes the thing that we share. The civic covenant binds our lives together. It encourages us to see our personal successes as the fruit of a larger collective achievement to which we owe a debt of gratitude. And it also causes us to grieve over the trials and sufferings of our fellow citizens. It's important. Both are very important. that of gratitude and a sense of that we're implicated in the failures of others just as much as we're implicated in their successes. As the post-war era's imperative of disenchantment has weakened the civic covenant, our societies have become more divided. Today, elites are more remote and also wealthier and more powerful than they were in the past. This is not a coincidence. A meritocratic mentality now supplants the civic covenant as the rationale for wealth and power. And this way of thinking regards power as an entitlement of the credentialed. The future of liberal democracy, to my mind, depends upon the renewal of our civic covenants. I've said on a number of occasions, people get outraged when I say this, but multiculturalism only works in empires. It is, for a democracy, it is an impossibility. You cannot have democracy in a multicultural society. It has to be united in it by a civic covenant in order to create the bonds of accountability that are necessary for a democratic society. Now, the greatest and highest covenant is the religious one. And faith exposes us to the full truth of our vulnerability. And it's a vulnerability that stems from the fact that the fate of our souls is not finally in our hands. It is also our most profound experience of security and stability. It's a paradox. It's our most profound experience of vulnerability, but also our most profound experience of stability and security. For our souls are in God's hands, and his power is supreme and everlasting. So the religious covenant relativizes our other loyalties. It smashes idols, but it does so not by relying on the post-war pattern of disenchantment and weakening, but instead by romancing our souls with a higher and more powerful enchantment. So in a moment where people are calling for re-enchantment, it's the higher and more powerful enchantments that we need, not disenchantment. The most reliable protection against a false and dangerous sacralization of ideology or of the nation or of the folk, all these things, or other populist perversions, the highest, the most reliable protection is not multiculturalism, and it's not post-national globalism. It is a love and loyalty that's ordered towards the highest good, which is God. That is the most reliable protection against perverted sacralization of the nation. So in conclusion, we're made for love, and love is a strengthening thing. We are, moreover, social animals, and thus the imperative of disenchantment and the pattern of weakening could never provide a satisfactory basis for public life. After 1945, I think that made sense as a cultural strategy. And there are times when dispassion plays a proper role. But the imperative of disenchantment has become too predominant and too obligatory. To a great degree, the banishment of love from our politics is creating the populism that presently troubles us. In some circumstances, we should support the populist call for the return of something worth loving. And we should tutor it as best we can. This will not be easy, but I console myself with the fact that nothing in public life is easy. And I think, moreover, that we owe it to my young friend in Australia to do what we can to make sure that the 20th century comes to a close. Thank you. Be happy to entertain questions. If people need to leave for class or something like that, I'm not at all. Yes?
So I was wondering if you could say a bit more about religious people, we might educate these incipient followers for the sacred. And in particular, there's one kind of very, what stood out to me is like quite a significant disconnection between the popular strongings and the three covenants, which is that the three covenants, they meet with really significant demands on the individual as well as kind of offering goods to enjoy and their sort of work together, I guess. And the demands kind of go very into people's lives or themselves to be bound by the three covenants so that, like, it's like a very central part of their lives and like something that covers most of all their sins, their interests, and their own. tenets or this into account was the populist longings, they involve a kind of collective identity. However, they're still like very much framed in terms of like liberal notions and kind of a focus on the self, that they're about like getting other people to do things or stop doing things. Immigrants should stop coming in, should enforce laws more strictly so that people can enjoy their collective identities. Right? And you see similar things with kind of the rise of sacred longings like on the left with farther extremes of identity politics that are also about having other people police their speech more so that people can secure their identities. So I'm wondering how you think we as Christians or the religious people who want to educate these populist movements can bridge that gap between like feeling your collective identity and actually being willing to let it permeate the entire life.
Right. No, that's a great question. You know, how to engage. Well, one thing is to, like I said, part of it is to recognize that we're socialized into disenchanting strategies to deal with perverted loves. I mean, that's our primary socialization. So we critique. That's a strategy of disenchantment, the idea of critique. Just to be aware of that, like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, that's different. You know, so I think there are two approaches to kind of Trumpian nationalism. One is nationalism is bad, and so it's bad to have this kind of rhetoric out there because it divides people, you know, leads to conflict, et cetera, excludes, blah, blah, blah. And that's a strategy of weakening. Another approach to Trump's nationalism is it's paper thin. I mean, it doesn't have any thickness or richness. And it doesn't, as you say, sort of engage what Abraham Lincoln called the mystic cords of memory that actually create a kind of reciprocal a sense of both that, you know, my country owes me something, but I owe something to it. And, you know, there's a way in which you could try to, those are two very different approaches, it seems to me, of criticism. One is we shouldn't have something so strong as nationalism. The other one is that that this is thin and superficial and needs to be strengthened, not weakened. So I think if you look at, you know, one of the things that also is, you know, I've kind of looked at, you could talk endlessly about Donald Trump. He's a sort of, he's the issue of our time, it seems, of our year. But if you look, I remember I watched the Republican convention and Ted Cruz gave kind of a classic Reagan speech, and I think he used the words freedom 100 times. And in Donald Trump's convention speech, I don't think he used the word freedom at all. And I thought, wow, what does this say? I mean, it's interesting to me, and I think we need to sort of think about how could someone win an election in America of all places and in a conservative and not run on freedom, which has been, that's been the conservative go-to word, you know, certainly as you know, William F. Buckley founding National Review against the kind of collectivist statist presumptions of American liberalism to defend freedom. That was his big project. That's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting change. But yeah, part of it is you seek for something solid and trustworthy. Oh, my friend, you have no idea how untrustworthy the nation state is. Let's look at something that won't betray you, I think, would be my approach. Yeah.
So, first of all, a tiny little point, which is, in defense of Julia Yaffe, I think her point was, meant as a commentary on what Trump's values were, not what America's values were.
Okay, fair enough.
She's an old friend from a
college. Well, okay, but unpack that for me.
I think her point was that Trump values pornography, and therefore it was meant as, Trump, if you want to go with Russia, that's what's
okay.
Going on there. So
thank you. That's helpful to me.
I think that's pretty clearly what you meant there. But as the broader point I'm interested in is, it seems like human rights could be held up as something that's sacred and a source of sanctity.
Mm-hmm. That's the way it was presented in the post-war era.
Yeah, I mean, Louis Hankin, right, was the very much came out of a religious viewpoint to him and his family. But I'm particularly interested in it from a Christian perspective, because when I think about the rhetoric you're using about particularism of love, love is confined to nation. That sounds to me very Jewish. So I'm curious how you can defend, I guess, an antipathy towards universal love as being kind of weak from a Christian theological perspective.
I was just making a note. You're saying human rights, sacredness, human dignity becomes this big term. And so, you know, the post-war era, we're going to, you know, in a sense, it's kind of a religious move. It's actually, you know, Sam Moyne's book was a big influence on me on Christian human rights, as well as The Last Utopia, to help unpack for me the way in which essentially conservative Christian politicians in the immediate aftermath of the war wanted to find something. You know, what I'm saying about religion, they wanted a kind of something that could be, you couldn't restore the Catholic Church to its role as the Pope, you know, limiting the power of the prince. That's not going to work in 1945. So instead, you opt for some metaphysically dense thing like human dignity. Yeah, I think that's how it worked, right? And that was meant to, human rights in the European context plays the role that the Constitution plays in the United States, which is it's the block against the absolutizing of politics. So I think that's right. You know, and the Catholic Church has been all in on that. And there's still lots of people who defend that as the way to go. But I'm not sure that the Human Rights Project hasn't itself become so heavily colonized by our own political struggles that it works that way anymore. It's now a site of our political conflicts, you know, as we expand what counts as a human right and all that sort of thing. And do we have any convincing account of human dignity? You know, so we have, it's got a rhetorically powerful charge to it, but we have a sort of an officially, as I say, materialist metaphysical view of the human person that doesn't seem to dovetail very well with the high view. I'm not sure it's going to work. It's become too thin because the strategy of disenchantment and weakening now affects that too. But
do you think? I mean, why should that be the case? I mean, liberals are very, very committed. Certainly, the neoliberal project is totally committed to the value of human rights. When you talked about, which I think is not possible, the European Court of Human Rights striking down an election, I think is, you know, that's not going to happen. But if it did, that would represent a real commitment to a sense of to a series of values. And certainly, when you talk to Germans and they talk about human dignity, it has this sacred quality to it. And I guess why doesn't that answer the modern person's yearning for sanctity and the sacred, which you think is what's leading to the current electoral mess?
Human dignity. So I have to respect human dignity, which means that underwrites obligatory disenchantment. I mean, it's an assault to human dignity to say that marriage is between a man and a woman. So all, you know, human dignity is people being able to live in accord with their own vision of the good, let's say. And so in order to do that, I have to eliminate everything that stands in the way of that. So I've written against human rights, you know, against human dignity, against human rights, against the Christian roots of Europe. I have a whole litany of things that I think that a lot of conservative Catholics fall back on that have become empty. And I think human rights is one of them for that reason. It now underwrites the mandatory weakening of culture and yeah.
Well, when I hear human dignity, I'm sorry, because of my education, I think of Imago Dei.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear your call to an engagement with a foundational notion of religion, I think about the human person as dignified because they are made in the image and likeness of the divine. When I read Richard Rubinstein's book, The Cunning of History, he said that the Holocaust in Germany and the prior Holocaust in the 20th century were the result of the weakening of the cultural notion of humanity made in the image of God. So I would just ask you to think about whether you could ground human dignity in the sense of the divine reality, and hence, without linking it to the neoliberal project, link it to the project of remembering religion.
No, I think these are related questions, and right. I don't think that. I mean, these are good challenges because help me think this through. I mean, people want a solid place to stand. People want something that's strong, not weak. Human dignity is a concept. You can't dwell in a concept. You can't live in a concept. You can't rest in a concept. And Imago Dei is a concept also. So, ultimately these have to be dense things that have a real particularity. So, they have to, so it could be religious communities, because they are dense things that involve practices and relationships, or marriage as something you enter into, not as an idea. One of the problems with nationalism is it tends to take an actual living community and turn it into an idea, an ideology. I think which is also actually alienating in the end. So that would be that's my sense that human dignity, it doesn't actually do the work that it's of providing people with a kind of existential home. So people want an existential home. They don't want a principle.
We have time for one final question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you draw a causal connection between this kind of weakening in terms of the state's strong moral norms and globalization and the advance of the neoliberal project and the decline of civic institutions like churches and synagogues?
What strong moral norms?
I'm sorry?
What strong moral norms?
Or the strong gods that you speak of.
Yeah.
Would you draw a connection between the decline of those concepts and the decline of the civic institutions that traditionally promulgated those norms outside kind of the ambit of the state?
Right, right. No, it's a really complicated question, and there's a chicken and egg question. I mean, has the weakening been an ideological project, or has the ideological project been strengthened by the market and being transformed from a citizen into a consumer? But they're clearly related to each other. It seems to me. Ultimately, these are always stories that you tell. So I've told a story about 1945 to present. Right, and it's a story that is primarily a story about a cultural response to a civilizational crisis. So I think that's the best way to see 1914 to 1945 is a civilizational crisis in the West that is on a huge order of magnitude, and that we in the West responded to that crisis, and our response to it was to disenchant and lower the temperature. And it took on a life of its own, it seems to me. It became a much more broader cultural project in 1968, and not just a political project. And after 1989, it actually went on autopilot for all kinds of complicated reasons. But you could tell another story if you're more Marxist in your orientation than I am. You might want to tell another story about that same time period. It doesn't disagree with me so much, but wants to put a lot more emphasis on the way in which we kind of reorganized our economic relations over the last 75 years that increased our atomization, our isolation, diminished the authority of traditional institutions, and so on and so forth. And I would love to read that story, but I did my PhD in theology and not in political theory or political economy, and so I tend to want to focus on what I see as the spiritual politics, if you will, of the world which we're currently living in, and the way in which that spiritual politics, which I would have endorsed, you know, if I had have liberated a concentration camp as a, I'm trying to think of who I talked to recently whose father was fought in World War II, and it was all in on the disenchantment project. You know, Hiroshima and Auschwitz. And so one is a Rawlsian, right, and no comprehensive schemes in politics. Please, no comprehensive schemes. Totally understandable. And if I'd have been his age, I would, I'm sure, have supported it. And I wouldn't have been wrong. I don't think he was wrong. But it's run its course, and it's overshot its mark, and that's what's afflicting us now. And that the big challenge that we face politically, in terms of the cultural politics of our time, is to try to figure out how, I was talking with Father Miss Campbell, how to actually, we're kind of in a 1930s moment, you're right? And then it was a kind of crisis of capitalism in America, and it had to be violated, and its principles had to be contradicted in order to save it. And I feel very similar about our liberal democratic project, which has taken on a kind of, has become highly ideological in the service of this pattern of weakening. And in order to save it, which I would like to do, I don't want to go back. we're going to have to think about, it's going to take a lot of temporizing, I think, going forward, as we try to figure out how to preserve the things like human dignity that we really care about that have become more and more difficult to articulate. Thank you very much.